terms of our progress, I really prepared this year thinking that we would do more than one pasuk, but we're not going to. There's just so much here on each pasuk. I mean, there are very few stories, certainly, or parshios like this that it's hard to pick and choose to leave stuff out. There's so much great pshat, so many great mefarshim, and certainly so much great midrashim and drush. Perhaps next week we'll try to do a few psukim, just so we can, you know, pick up speed. But be that as it may, I do try to balance it. I just haven't figured out how to do it. But I think that you know, the basic story we know already, so there's no point in rushing. The point of the whole shir is to do things more in depth, to gain a greater understanding, and if we're going a little slow, so you'll rack this up into the Chafetz Chaim school of Chumashurim, as the joke goes about their Gemara Shurim. Anyway, okay. So we are back, and we are still right in the throes of Chava, and now we have Adam's cataclysmic choice to eat from the Eitz HaDaas. We mentioned last week we were only doing one pasuk, but it was the single most pivotal pasuk in human history, and that was not an exaggeration. The very fact that Adam and Chava chose to eat the Eitz HaDaas literally changed history forever, brought death to the world, brought labor pains to the world, brought work to the world, brought lots of things to the world that would never apparently have been. And that's certainly of inestimable consequence, primarily Lara. In light of that, you know, everything after that is a downer. There's no other pasuk that's going to be as consequential. But again, each one of these pasukim and the unfolding story, which we are certainly seeing at a slow but in-depth pace, is really still very, very pivotal. So it's fascinating, actually, to consider, now that we know that Adam and Chava ate from the Eitz HaDaas, what is going to be the first pasuk after? What's the first thing that's described afterwards? You know, it's fascinating to consider what the different possibilities would have been. And let's keep in mind for a moment the fact that the Torah itself, way back in Parak Beis, who knows what pasuk, itself already gave a description to Adam, maybe to Chava as well. We've mentioned that in the past. It's not clear if Chava also knew this directly from Hashem. But the Torah itself also gave a description of Eitz HaDaas. What did the Torah tell us? What pasuk are we on? Parak Beis, pasuk, who knows? Pasuk Tef, very good. Right, how Hashem planted this special, delicious, pretty tree right in the middle of the garden. The Eitz HaChaim, B'toch HaGan, and we're not reviewing. We spent when we were on Parak Beis, we discussed the different explanations of the relationship between Eitz HaDaas and Eitz HaChaim, two different trees, one tree, but intertwined, different mefarshim. But how is Eitz HaDaas described there? Hadas Tov Vara. Right? And then, so we have that's Hashem's statement himself. And we saw certainly, based on some mefarshim, that wasn't Hashem wasn't whispering that to Adam or to Chava. That was loud enough that the snake apparently knew about it. In fact, we saw from one medrash last week that part of the way the snake tricked Chava was basically saying, listen, I heard what Hashem said. You didn't hear. Right? You were born after the tzivoy when Hashem puts Adam to sleep and creates you from his rib. So, obviously, part of the discussion is what the snake says. And what does the snake say to Chava that the power of the tree is? Right, when the previous psukim, what did the snake say? Right, the power of creation. And we saw that the Medrash elaborated on this, at least according to one opinion, and suggested that the snake formulated a theory that perhaps the power of all creation was in this tree, to the point that perhaps Hashem himself needed the tree to create the rest of the world. Which is, you know, illogical on some level, but as I said to one of you last week, it's not any more illogical than most other theories of the creation of the world other than a traditional one. In other words, we believe that there's a compelling logic. There's obviously lots of leaps of faith, but we believe there's a certain compelling logic, as have a certain percentage of philosophers throughout the millennia, that whoever is the first cause has to also be the prime cause. Right? The thought that there could be a object, in this case, of all things, a tree, which somehow predates God, and then God uses the tree to create the rest of the world, so then, I think it was Joel, somebody said, well, how could that be? Who created the tree? So I said, that makes sense to us. But, you know, going back to Rabbi Akiva and the Gemara, who was trying to explain, you know, he says, you know, you see the watch, who made the watch, someone had to make it. But the bottom line is many people, otherwise very smart people over the millennia, have believed in various theories. Apparently, unbeknownst to them, perhaps the snake came up with it first. And it was good enough that apparently it got Chava too. So, a lot of power by Hashem and Lahavdil, the snake, has been ascribed to the tree. In fact, right, the snake didn't just use the type of intellectual arguments, the snake used a very biting, so to speak, emotional argument, which is, why does Hashem not want you to eat from it? Because he wants to keep the powers all to himself. Right? Again, as we've moved on from some of the Musar that we did the last 2 weeks in terms of the universal, the Torah here, especially with the Midrashim, described such universal and common psychological motives for sin, feelings, and we'll do a little bit of the feelings in terms of the result of sin tonight, but not focusing so much on how people fall prey to sin. That was the last 2 weeks, Ashir and the snake and the vulnerabilities that he found in Chava, and even to extent in Chava we saw last week, the vulnerabilities that she found to be able to get Adam to eat, as well as some incredible midrashim that we saw last week. But the bottom line is, a lot of incredible power has been ascribed to the tree. So now, after all of that buildup, they've eaten from the tree. So now, what would you imagine would be the reaction? What's the result? So with all of that buildup, comes our Pasuk Zion. What does the Torah tell us? Tipakachna einei shneihem. And it's worth noting already that whoever's fault it was, whoever was ate first, whoever ate second, at this point, it's irrelevant, right? From the objective perspective, from, if you will, the narrator / Hashem's perspective, it's irrelevant. They both ate. Shnehem, no distinction. And what was the result? The tipakachna einei shnehem. And both of their eyes were opened. V'yedu ke'irumim heim. And only now, I'm adding the only now they realize they're naked. What's their instinctive reaction to that? The yisperu alei te'ina. They sewed together a fig leaf. Ya'asu lehem chagoros. And they made for themselves some type of apron or some type of clothing. I didn't include it. It was a last minute deletion. It would have been the last source on the sheet, but I don't think it's adding too much. There is a medrash that suggests that because the chagorot here is in plural, it does not mean, which, what's the simple understanding why it's in plural? Two people. Right? But the medrash understands that it alludes to the fact that there were multiple garments, not just as it's envisioned throughout the millennia in, you know, artist renditions, or for that matter, I don't know, in cartoons or whatever, with, you know, just the fig leaf around the waist, and you may imagine maybe with a chava something around her chest, but according to the Medrash, actually each one of them had three different appropriately covering garments, and the Medrash describes the type of pants, the type of this. The Medrash even suggests, just as an aside, the Medrash even talks about her wearing something over her head. The third of the three garments that the Medrash says is something on her head. But be that as it may, that's the schagoros, is meant to be, you know, what the plural is here. Not important, I don't think, as much. Even I am going at one pasuk per shir, leaves out certain things, you see? And not that we're doing everything. Certain things I didn't think were important enough to do. But that's just so you should know. Now, before we see Rashi, and use Rashi step by step as a launching pad to see some other mafarshim and midrashim, and understanding some of the treasures that are hidden in this pasuk and this description, just for a moment, as we always try to do, let's think about the pasuk itself on a pshat level. And here I'm really looking for one thing very specifically. It's really two things that are really one. What doesn't jive? What needs explanation from either a literary or even a grammatical perspective? What about the pasuk from a strictly pshat perspective needs explanation? And if we can anticipate that, if we can figure that out, so then we'll better appreciate whether it's the pashtonim or even the midrashim, how they attempt, what they add to the pasuk, if we realize what pressure they were coming to alleviate, or what question they were coming to answer. What do we need to understand from the pasuk itself? What begs to be answered?
I guess the same issue like last week, I'm guessing.
Good, continue.
Now, last week the question was, she saw. Does it mean she saw, or did she understand? So I guess it's...
Good. So that's the 1A. The 1A is the tipakachna. They saw. What do you mean they saw? As we'll see in a moment, Mefarshim asked, what, they were blind until now? They didn't see anything until now? What do you mean they saw? All of a sudden they saw, right? This wasn't carrots. No one, there's various opinions to what Eitz HaDaas was. We're going to see them again tonight. But no one says that it was carrots. It wasn't all of a sudden, you know, a B12 shot. Of course they could see. They didn't make them see any better. So that's question number one. But question number two, which is really what it kind of puts it together, is in light of the fact that the Torah uses the term tibakachna, and in light of the fact that they use the specific term ene, which does certainly mean eyes, that's not subject to interpretation, what subsequent word in the pasuk is difficult to understand? V'yedu. Right? Right. It should have been v'yiru. Right? It should have been v'yiru, not v'yedu. Now again, in light, and I'm glad you remembered it, Bernie, in light of the discussion last week, it's almost obvious what the answer should be. Right? If you take the seeing so literally, on the one hand you're bothered in the beginning, and then you're bothered at the end. But in light of the fact that we gave almost an identical answer last week, it's not surprising that the v'yedu is, we could look at it as a question, but it's almost already keying us into what the solution is going to be. We're obviously not talking about vision here. We're talking about what?
Understanding.
So let's take a look. In light of that, let's use that as a starting point to see some of the discussions of the parsha. So take a look at Rashi. Rashi on Pasuk Zayin begins. Tibakachna. L'inyan hachachma. Right? It doesn't mean, right, go see Dr. Elman or Dr. Kelman. It's nothing to do with ophthalmology. It's l'inyan hachachma. It's talking about a matter of wisdom, of understanding Divar HaKasav. That's what the Torah was talking about. V'lo l'inyan ri'iya mamish. It has nothing to do with actual sight. Says Rashi, v'sof ha-mikra mochiach. Once you start off, you think you have one question, but as so often is the case, the second question answers the first. Which is, why does it say v'yedu? Says Rashi, beautiful, it's not a second question, it's the answer to the first question. The very fact that it says v'yedu in the continuation of the pasuk proves that we weren't talking about the power of sight, but rather the power of understanding. If you take a look at the source sheet, you'll see a bevy of other sources that more or less agree with and somehow, in a certain sense, amplify this approach to Rashi. Take a look at the Ramban. The Ramban so often is, you know, quoting Rashi usually to make, like, if you'll forgive the expression, a rag doll out of him. You know what I mean? Usually it's Ramban when he quotes Rashi or Ibn Ezra to then disagree with him. But here you have one of those examples where not only does the Ramban quote Rashi adding really nothing, he decides, but I'll also let you know a proof for Rashi. I'll give you Rashi even more support. So it says the Ramban, V'tibakachna yinei shnehem, l'inyan hachachma diber hakasuv, lo l'inyan ri'iya mamish, v'sof ha-mochiach, as Rashi says, k'loshan Rashi. What does the Ramban add with his great, wide-ranging knowledge, with his bekiyas? He gives you another example in Tanakh, which, you know, gives us a sense that this is not something that's being forced into the text, but rather there's a pattern here. As the wall, the pasuk says in Tehillim, Gal Einai, right? We, so to speak, Davent Hashem, if we take it literally, reveal or open my eyes, Abita Niflaos Mitorasecha, so that I should be able to understand the wonders of your Torah. So if it said wonders of your nature or something like that, so then maybe it would have really meant literally see. Give me opportunities to see the wonders of the world or something. But clearly, by the fact that the pasuk's context here is plumbing the depths of Torah, so obviously it doesn't mean give me better vision to be able to, you know, read by a burning candle late at night. It means give me greater wisdom and understanding to understand the secrets of the Torah. Says the Ramban, that's the same idea here. So again, what you see from the Ramban, you see from Rashi, is that this choice of terminology is, maybe it's vivid and it creates a certain metaphor and a vision for us, no pun intended, but ultimately the Torah is describing a certain intellectual apprehension that Adam and Chava have in the moment. And at this point, there's no value judgment, frankly, on the knowledge, it seems to be, or any specific mention of a type of or a form of knowledge, but a greater general sense of enlightenment. That's the gist of Rashi and the Ramban. The Sforno agrees that we're talking about a level of understanding, but the Sforno makes it much more specific and certainly adds a certain negative connotation. Says the Sforno, not new lay, second source on your sheet, el kol arev l'hisanog, l'hisaneg, afal pishi yazik. They all of a sudden became aware of every, how should I say, base desire, Even those that are self-destructive, afal pishi yazik, even those that are completely destructive and beyond limit, But they became completely, this doesn't necessarily mean that they were consumed or obsessed with it, but they became fully aware, not just of, the most noble or sublime element of physicality or even sexuality, but that and an entire range, even of the most base things, even the ones that would be self-injurious. And then he just adds, by the way, he also agrees with the Ramban that this general idea that, eyes or vision can reference understanding, so he says again, this is also a pattern, kisima sleva hashgacha v'dabra tikra pikichas ayin, right? A pikeach, right? We often use this phrase even in modern Hebrew. Right? A pikeach is someone who has great understanding, is intuitive wisdom. Right? Pikeach means as vision. And even in the English language, vision can have a double meaning. The Sforno adds a new element. Perhaps you'd even say he's arguing on Rashi, I'm not sure. But one thing for sure he's agreeing with Rashi and the Ramban is that this pasuk and this phrase is relating to an observation about a transformation in Adam and Chava now. I stress that at the moment. I stress that because everything we saw until now should be contrasted with the Chizkuni. The Chizkuni is borrowing from a Medrash, and as we often try to do, we'll see first how the Mefarish quotes the Medrash, and then we'll take a look at the Medrash itself. But look at the Chizkuni who's quoting a Medrash, and see what I mean when I say that in a certain fundamental way, the Chizkuni is branching out and has a different perspective entirely, even though he's agreeing, again, no one suggests this is about vision. It's all about some level of understanding. But whereas the Ramban, Rashi, Sforno talk about Adam and Chava's self-awareness in the moment, some of the changed them at the moment, says the Chizkuni something else. He asked the question, as I alluded to before, "B'chisumin hayu?" Were they blind that all of a sudden, ooh, they got a great procedure and all of a sudden they could see? No! Ela nistaklu, they were able to see in a double sense. V'hevinu, they understood. Now again, not some general thing that Rashi and Rabban told us, not even something very specific and perhaps negative that Sforno says the Chizkuni, "Shehera lehema kadosh baruch hu, Kamadoros ibdu bishvilam." They were granted a horrific prophetic vision. They had a sense, all of a sudden, oh my gosh, look at the destruction that's going to come to the world because of us. Look at all of the death, and again, in very vivid terms, Kamadoros ibdu, how many generations, how much will be lost to the world on many levels, in the most profoundly sorrowful way, because of what we do. That's what they saw. Patipa kachna, oh my goodness. We have an awareness, not some new awareness of who they were now. Sforno talks about physicality or sexuality. Nothing to do with that. Whether the Chizkuni agrees or not, that happened to Adam, I don't know. But that's not what's being alluded to here. What's being alluded to here is not a transformation of them in the present. It's an awareness of the cataclysmic results of their sin. And this really does touch back on something that we saw last week, right, where, at least according to the one of the Midrashim, right, Chava, the second that she took from the Eitz Hadas, what did we say? Ra'asa, according to that Midrash, Malach HaMavis Befaneha. Which, again, it's the language of the Midrashim is like so poetic, but the point of that Midrash is clear, which is, as we said, it's so universal. Halavai, because when it's not universal, when it doesn't apply to us, it's a problem, but it's so often the case that when we're consumed with something, we have this incredible desire, it leads us astray, and we do the Avera, and the moment, mamash, we don't even get like a second to enjoy, because the moment we do the Avera, it's like a knife. Guilt. Shame. Oh my, if I could just have it back. Can we rewind for a minute? And that was what that Medrash very powerfully said happened to Chava. She second she ate it. She couldn't even enjoy it. Rasa Malach HaMavis. So here you have, along the same theme, a different Mefarish, and again we'll see in a moment, it also comes from a Medrash. Same, again, the message that's being conjured up here is the same thing. They never had to feel shame. That was new. There was a Tiba Kachla. There was something new. There was a new awareness. There was an awareness of shame, of the consequences of what they've done, and they can never get it back. It's too late. Some things can't be made right. It's too late. And it's not something that just affected them, but kama doros ibdu. How many ramifications there are for future generations.
My friend hasn't really told them their punishment yet.
Exactly, which is really fascinating. Which is really fascinating. And yet, they had an awareness. But again, I think on a very, you know, it's clear that Chazal very much is as distant as the Avos were, so to speak, from us. And the world of Gan Eden is like light years away, you could imagine, in terms of just how the world worked. Nevertheless, as different as it was, it's clear for all the Midrashim and Mepharshim we saw in the last few weeks, right? We're obviously meant to very much see ourselves or see lessons from the story. And I think in that case, Alan, your point, while true, but it's also still relevant in the sense of how often is the case, right? Before we know, you know, what the principal is actually going to tell us as our punishment, you know you're in trouble.
They were already told the punishment.
When? Okay, good. That's also true. And we're not sure if they took it literally or not. Even if they took it literally, they might have been wrong. Right? Again, a different medrash, right? One of the other opinions of medrash last week we saw, right? That was again, there were so many incredible makaros from that shir from those medrashim last week, right? That opinion, right, that said that had a chava get Adam to do it, that she was convinced she was going to die. This is an unbelievable medrash, right? What was the most painful thing for her? Not that she'll die, but that Adam's going to get remarried.
Right.
So at least if I'm going to die, let him die with me, or maybe who knows? Maybe there'll be a lifeline. Maybe we'll both somehow survive. So that so clearly they took it literally. Even though, if you may recall, when we were learning, 6 months ago, whenever Perek Beis. Pasuk Tes on that pasuk of Eitzat Tavra and then pasuk of Mos Tamuz, I think it was the Eben Ezra or the Reb Sajig on somebody that we saw in the class of Mepharshim pointed out, it doesn't mean, it never meant literal death. What it meant is some difficulty/shortening of life, but not immediate death. But she thought it was, and we know again their misperception of either the prohibition or the punishment is, as we know, what's what got her, or perhaps according to Tartzmima, him in trouble. But that's revisiting 3 weeks ago and blaming it on the man, which I'm sure is popular with at least half this year, but no need to revisit now.
How would the Dorah affected by this?
The sense of... First of all, they may not even know the specifics, but the very fact that there's death brought to the world, the very fact that they're taken out of Gan Eden and everything bad that's going to happen in the world, which presumably never would have happened. Remember for a moment that when we saw some of the Midrashim on the creation of Adam and Chava, and the Medrash said that there was a machlokes, right, whether to create Adam or not. And what was one of the arguments against Adam? Look who's going to come from him. And it described, I forget which Rishayim, was it Menashe, I forget who. You know, this, look, what's going to come from this one Adam? Says, yeah, but on the other hand, Moshe's going to go. So there's very much, as much as we say about the Avos, that there was, destiny in future generations embodied in their actions, al achas kama v'kama, Adam and Chava certainly in Gan Eden, there were, again, this is in ways that we can't necessarily understand.
The Yetzer Hara that went on to generation that were...
That too. But even more than that, the very fact that there's death, the punishments that we're going to see at the end of the parish...
They were intended to live for...
I don't mean to minimize it.
Was the implication that they were going to be immortal?
Yes. And again, and have a relatively easy life, right? You don't have to work for a living. You may have children, but without pain. I mean, lots of good things. And look at everything that happened. Take a look just for a moment, because I want to move on. But take a look at the Medrash. You just see it itself. Inside, the Medrash says, this is what the Chizkuni was basing himself on. The Medrash asks, Chisumim hayu, sort of Yudin b'shem, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Zakkai, Rabbi Brechi, b'shem Rabbi Akiva Amar, a mashal. And again, here, this is interesting, the Chizkuni doesn't give us this, but I think the mashal adds a little flavor as well. Mashal, the Erone, which means basically someone who was very poor from the small, hick town, Shehaya Ober, Lifnei Chanuso, Shel Zagag. And, he gets on, it's like the stereotypical Amish kid, he gets on the bus and goes to the big city, and he's walking through, downtown, and he's in the big city, and he sees very big and opulent and wealthy stores. He sees in a particular case here, he goes to this incredible, like a glass or a silver, some kind of store. Pailopon of Kupa Malaya, Kosos Badai Trutin. And he sees, this incredible, showcase of great crystal and cups and goblets and incredible stuff. And this is stuff that in his little town he has never seen. He's bewildered by all the beautiful things. But what happens? He's clumsy. But Tafsan Bamaklo Vishibran, right? And his staff or something, he's trying to go through the aisles and, he breaks it. He knocks him down and he breaks it. Ahmad V'tafso, and the owner, you know, like grabs him by the lapels, and he says to him, Yoda ana, the less ana mehene mimchakum. You would think, all right, so if you're the owner, you just made a sale, right? You make it, you break it, you bought it. But he knows, look at this kid, he doesn't have money for what he just broke. I know, he screams, you think I gained anything from you? Ela bo v'are'e l'cha kama tovos ibadata. Right, but let me tell you, you want to go see the invoice? You should just know what you broke, right? It wasn't just stomable. You know, this was, I don't know, a 13th century Ming vase, and I don't know, and it would cost thousands of dollars, you know? Not because he had to pay for it. The owner gave up on that already. But he wanted him to just, you should appreciate how cataclysmic, how terrible it was, your carelessness. Says the Medrash in conclusion, kach hera lehen kama doros ibdu. So to hear, it's not like there's anything Adam and Chava could do about it. Hashem wasn't telling them this so that they could then fix it. Hashem, there was a certain causality here that was unfixable. But nevertheless, Hashem wanted them at that moment to realize in a way that if it was just left to their own eyes, they couldn't see to the future, they would have just seen, right, you know, I'm going to be kicked out of the garden, and I'm going to have to work a little bit, you know, it's bad. But that wouldn't have given them a fraction of a fraction of how bad it was. Hashem wanted them to really appreciate it. So now, let's just move on for a moment. So the pasuk continues and says that now they have this envision, this enlightenment, the Yedu Ki Arumim Heim, and they now know, you know, we're naked. The emperor has no clothes. The emperor has two. There's no clothes. So it's just interesting. Take a look. For a moment, you see the Sforno is very consistent. We know that the Sforno, in the first part of the pasuk, already is focusing on this part of human existence. It says the Sforno, Yedu Kierumim, the next source on your sheet, Yedu Sheroi Lachasos Makom Ha'erva. It was at this moment, again, it wasn't that they all of a sudden realized they weren't wearing clothing. They already weren't wearing clothing. Take a look even at, just for a moment, you don't have to take a look inside, because Rashi here takes us in another direction, which I don't want to go. But Rashi, on this part of the pasuk, also says, even a blind person knows when he's not dressed, he can feel himself. So even if you thought, you know, like, no matter what you understood in the pasuk, all of a sudden now they knew they were naked? Of course they knew they were naked. So the Sforno, again, in light of that observation, which all the Mefarshim assume, says, what's the deeper message here? Yedu Sharoi, they understood that there was something wrong with nakedness, as opposed to before then. Why? And again, here the Sforno is Lashitasa, the Sforno is working off of what he just said momentarily, a moment ago. Vios me'ata rov pulasu mukuvenes lis'anug ma'us umazik. Again, the Sforno, it's basic traditional Jewish belief. Again, very much different than Christianity, that there can be something very ennobling and sublime about human sexuality. But it's also true that there is at least, even if you wanted to be generous and say it's half and half, there's at least a second half of the equation. And the real truth is that in terms of human experience and human psychology, left to our own devices, men perhaps more than women, but I think over human history it would not just be limited to men. There's, right, it lends itself, it naturally runs its course in a base direction, not an ennobling, in a holy direction. So they realize, what's uncovered is something which is actually, you know, it's not like my hands, which maybe are usually for good, but can be for bad, or something like that. Because that's true about every organ of the body. But these are organs which are going to be, again, not just for themselves so much, but for human history, something that, again, uncontrolled and untempered, going to be primarily debased. And therefore, specifically, they understood that has to be covered. And even though he doesn't quote him, Rav Hirsch, and his comments, actually going back in Pasuk in Perek Beis, Rav Hirsch also, when he's explaining the notion of why, you know, they had a certain embarrassment, and the fact that all of a sudden they had a certain shame, they needed to cover themselves. So Rav Hirsch also, again, ties this into a general notion of their awareness and their own sense of Kedusha, Kodem HaChet, before they sinned, and then the result after the Chet. And he speaks about the idea that beforehand, as we saw from other Mefarshim, there was a certain complete unity to the body and to the spirit, and everything was really holy. And therefore, as we saw, there were some Midrashim that suggest that even before this, Adam and Chava had already been intimate. But as we saw from the Mefarshim, that was no different than eating, no different than walking. It was just a human biological act, and those organs were no different than the hand and the nose and everything else. However, says Rav Hirsch, once the chait happened, once they defiled themselves with that chait, if you take a look at the part I underlined, as soon as man hands over the reins to his sensuousness and does not exercise moral energy to raise his sensual life up to the realm of godliness, on the contrary, sensuality, his godliness itself, gets dragged down into the untrue state of the senses, then at once he has to be ashamed of his nakedness. And what I think is actually so insightful here, he doesn't come out and say it explicitly, but what he's clearly saying is, one could ask, again, we haven't yet, we've alluded to it in Parak Beis, and maybe we'll have another share about this, I haven't decided yet, to go through all the different shitos as to what was Eitz Hadas. I don't mean in terms of the type of fruit or something, but what was Tov HaRav mean? This famous, the beginning of Mor Nevuchim is all about this, the famous Ramban, which we actually did see a little bit of already, so I'm not sure if we'll review. We did some part of this, whether it added Bechira Chavshus or not, did they have free choice before this? There's a lot of very famous philosophical issues in Torah here, but where Rav Hirsch is coming in is basically saying, even if you imagine that this tree and its natural or instinct, you know, powers, has nothing to do with sexuality, it still could have led to exactly this point. Why? Because it's that, out of all of the parts of the human, personality or characteristics, is such where, literally, you know, if you open up a little bit, it's a disaster. In other words, this ability to speak in absolute, not just it can be sublime or it can be noble, but that it was 100%, you know, there's nothing to be embarrassed about, complete kedusha. So that was only true, Rav Hirsch is saying, when their entire life, not just that part of their life, the entire life was being lived in complete discipline with Hashem's desire, with Ratzon Hashem. The second they deviated from that, even though maybe this fruit had nothing to do with sexuality, but the second they deviated from that, and all of a sudden they exhibited a ratzon which was not necessarily going to be consistent with ratzon Hashem, even if you're, so to speak, poking a hole in the dam on this side, but it's going to break at its most vulnerable point. And the most vulnerable point of human persona is this, you know, in terms of our moral challenges for humanity, is in this part, right? Which again, Chazal in other contexts say that this is the greatest Yetzer Hara for humanity. So even though maybe, you know, the dam has been breached in a different part, what does Eitz Hadas have to do with this? But where it's going to have its most immediate first impact, when all of a sudden, once there's a little bit of Hefkeres, so it's not, the first thing that humans are going to do is not necessarily run to eat what they want to eat, or run to rob a bank. They might get to that too, if there was lawlessness. But the first thing that comes down when you have the break in discipline and, you know, complete shiva to Ratzon Hashem is this part of human personality and human Yetzer Hara. And that's, as a first, that's why the first reaction was to cover themselves.
It's interesting that Hashem didn't orchestrate it from the very beginning that the only prohibition that they would have would be something in the realm of Arayos. It was something else.
Right.
Yet,
because as long as it's working in terms of the human discipline and so then there was no need to differentiate. It's a good insight. I'm agreeing with you. There's as long as they were in that state, it's hard to even find the right words to describe it. But as long as they were in that state, then there was no need. Then there was no need. Once the dam broke, even a little bit, so then the first thing that became vulnerable, that they themselves were aware of, Hashem didn't need to tell them that, they themselves were aware, was in this part of human characteristics.
So really, you could say the opposite also. You could say that as we see the beings work to get rid of Averis, to get rid of sin, that is the last Averis that we've ever...
If it left up to us.
People,
yes.
You know, again, now it's...
Now it is true, I agree with you, it is true that there are all sorts of people who focus on, you know, different parts of the present. There are some people who can become, you know, very, very zahir in that before they're equally zahir in other things. But the truth is that's not so common, and it doesn't always work. We have certain people, you know, we know who are, you know, they walk around with blinders, and I say, in theory, that could be wonderful, except if I get the blinders, again, I don't mean to be completely stereotypical, but the blinders sometimes don't always apply when they're in the bank, and they're filling out the tax returns. In other words, even if the zahirus in that regard is wonderful, you know, you don't have somebody who's, you know, I'll give you as an example, just to show you what, like a malach, I mean this almost literally, again, example of someone who was like so came out of Malach that they could almost break what you're saying was Rav Kook. Rav Kook, I believe it was from the time he was 13, other than his wife and immediate family members, never looked another woman in the eyes. It was Tarei Naim, and I was 13. I don't know if he necessarily recommended it to any of his students. He also wore tefillin all the time. And the other Talmidim in the Volozhiner Yeshiva were jealous. And they went to the Netziv, and with Rosh Yeshiva, and they said, "Nu, how can we let him?" He says, "He has rules, and you have rules." So people who are certain malachim, so they may not only be able to accomplish such a level, they may even be able to do it out of order, so to speak. I agree with you. But for the rest of us, I think your point is exactly true. That not only is our instinct to push it off until the last moment, but we may not be at the level that we could accomplish it until the last moment. Because again, it is, the only thing that's in close second, say Chazal, is money. Right? Which is why it's so often the case that people can somehow accomplish the conquer one Yitzhar or not the other. To conquer them both is an incredible thing. Okay. Let's move on to focus a little bit on the end of the Pasuk, which is interesting in its own right. Plus, I even brought in props. You'll see, I have things to give out. At least pictures for you to see. But before we get to the fun part of this year, and my props, let's just review the end of the pasuk, because there's a whole other dimension that needs to be reviewed, and that this pasuk is a key in. What was the end of the pasuk? Now that they know that they're naked, yisperu alei teina, they used fig leaves, they bound them or sewed them together, and they made these clothes, aprons, whatever, for themselves. So, needless to say, for those who recall, obviously there is an identification here for the first time in all of Tanakh of a particular tree or of a particular herbage or plant life called a fig. Right? We have never had that until now. The Torah never even identified what the Eitz HaDaas is. They certainly didn't identify orange trees and apple trees, even though we know they must have been there, and plum trees. They didn't exist. They didn't identify them. The first thing that is identified is the fig tree. And this is considered consequential, not by all, by a whole group of Mefarshim, and even by at least one opinion in Chazal. Namely, that this is viewed by many as, why Dafka do we care? Why do we need to know this for? There was a fig leaf. So many see this as connecting to the million-dollar question, which is, identity of the Eitz HaDaas. So take a look for a moment, even at the bottom of your sheet. It's the famous Gemara in Brachos, which we have seen in an earlier shiur. As you keep the sheets, you've already seen this before. You have this now twice in your records. The famous Gemara in Brachos, which quotes three opinions. Again, there's a Medrash, which adds another opinion. The Esrog is not in the Gemara. The Esrog is in the Medrash. But they have the opinion here that maybe it's grapes, maybe it would be wheat. One opinion was, and there was another opinion that said maybe the Eitz HaDaas itself was a fig tree. What was the proof? Rabbi Nechemia Omar, Teina Haisa, it was a fig tree. Shebedavar Shenes Kalkul Ubo, Nitkenu. That which messed them up, which got them in trouble, the fig tree, the Eitz HaDaas, that's how they, so to speak, corrected or protected themselves. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Vyisperu Alei Teina. Take a look at the back of the sheet. You see this opinion, again, Bereishis Rabba in Perek Yotes, Vav, which is, again, right on our Pasuk, V'yisperu alei teina, also mentions, Amr Shem and Yochai, alei shehibiu to'ena la'olam, the same leaf or the same tree that brings disaster and calamity to the world is the one which is being used now, i.e., we can use this to identify the tree, and Amr Rav Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak says, this corresponds to like common slang, I guess, I don't know, in the Tanakh. You know, they had idioms and slang in the Tanaitic period. Every now and then the Gemara does this also. It'll say, about such and such a phenomenon, there is the following idiom or slang. What's the slang here that they sometimes use? Kilkalta. If somebody makes a mistake, we'll say, Kilkalta, Ovarech, you've destroyed your own work, your own labor, Savchut v'chayit. Why don't you go take, a needle and thread and sew it up? In other words, there's a reference when somebody, so to speak, does something that needs to be fixed with the very thing they hurt. So the same imagery was used already, in the idiom in this time of Chazal, which again references the same phenomenon, that if you mess yourself up in one thing, you should use that itself to correct it.
But that flies in the face of what the Mefarshim said. It would seem to me if there's...
Which Mefarshim?
People Kachmoy, they realize... So, Doros were lost.
Why is that?
It seems to me that human nature would be, that if I went to the tree and I ate from it and I saw the disaster I've just caused, I would not touch that tree.
Good, so good, very good. So that's a perfect segue, Gene, to the next midrash. Perfect segue. It says, if we choreographed it. What does the next midrash say? What?
I'm your straight man.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, well, my wife never ceases to remind me that I am not funny, so I need someone else to help me. Okay, and you do a good job. Rabbi Yossi Omer says, Bereishis Rabbah. This is, again, now an elaboration. Again, we have all these different midrashim all coming together to express, again, it's only one opinion, but you have a lot of discussion about this one opinion that it was a fig tree. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Te'enim Hayu. Right? It was a Te'ena. Dabar Lamed Mi'inyano. And again, the very fact, again, also assuming that from the very fact that the Torah itself makes reference to fig leaves, we can assume that it's a fig tree. But now the Medrash gives us a Mashal, which answers Jean's question. It wasn't so much that they wanted it. Mashal Leben Sarim. There was a prince, the son of a great czar, or, you know, king, Shakilkel Im Achas Men Hashvachos. And he got himself in trouble. He got caught doing something he shouldn't have been doing with one of the maidservants. Kevan Shishama Hasar, once his father, the king, found out, Tardu Hotsio Chutzla Palace, and he threw him out of the palace. You're the bad son, you are out of the palace. So he needed a place to go. He's bumming for a place to sleep. Fahayamafsar al Petchehan Shmachos, and he's going to this one and this woman and this woman. Falaya Makabalos also, and none of them wanted to be anywhere near him. He's nothing but trouble. Aval Osa Shukilkula, the very woman who he got in trouble with, Imo, she opened the door and let him in. Says the Medrash, this very vivid image is a mashal for the following thing that happened with Adam and Chava. Kach, so the same thing happened. Adam and Chava ate from that tree, whatever it would have been. Maybe we wouldn't have known, but now we think it's a fig tree. Why? Tirdu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem gets so upset. Now again, this seems a bit, according to the way it's presented in the Torah, anachronistic, because we haven't yet been told that they're exiled from Gan Eden, but here in the Medrash, the order seems to be a little bit mixed up. But what happened? The bottom line is they made a mistake. They did something wrong. They went to all the trees. First they went to this tree and that tree. They went to an oak tree. Right? They went to, I didn't go to, you know, Mira Woods, but a lot of trees out there. Right? With lots of pretty leaves. Maybe it was even in the fall and they were changing colors and it was, you know, they went to all these trees. They wanted to use their leaves. None of the trees wanted to let them benefit from their leaves. What did the trees say to Adam and Chava that they should, you know, get away from me? Rabbi Brechia, they said, when Adam, you know, approached, hey, Ganav, this is the thief, the god of Dat de Barye, that, so to speak, was Gonev Das. It doesn't mean the way we use the term, like tricking, but basically was disloyal, betrayed, I guess is the best word, betrayed the Das of Hashem. So they basically, or other Midrashim said when they would approach it, look, there's the Russia. Like no one else in Gan Eden wanted to have anything to do with them. So Nebuch, they went from tree to tree until finally, about the fig, who had been in the same mess as Adam himself, as if opened up his door, spread open his leaves, and said, "Take for me hadahu d'chsev," and that's the pasuk in our part, that's our pasuk, "Yisperu alei te'ina." Exactly. Now it's interesting, just as an aside, because again, these are makaros that most of us have not previously been familiar with. So just to see the continuation of the Medrash, it gives us some very interesting things. So now that the Medrash is convinced it's a fig tree, the Medrash wants to know, well, what type of fig tree it is. And I'm not an expert in this. I don't know if any of these things actually correspond to real life fig trees that a scientist or someone who knows these things would be aware of. But the first opinion says the Medrash, what kind of fig tree was it? What's known as a baras sheva. What does that mean? The allusion to seven. The Amtayis Zayin Yimei Avla Da Alma. Because it was this tree that brought the notion of sitting Shiva to the world. I.e. it brought death to the world. And again, according to this Medrash, it was a form of a fig tree that is known by name that alludes to this. Or, for that matter, Rabbi Yeshua says, and Rabbi Elazar says, something else called Baras Alisa. Alisa is some reference to crying or wailing. The Amtias Alisa La'ama. Because the whole notion of wailing, of tragedy, of disaster in the world, again, only resulted from the catastrophic decision of Anchava to eat with this tree. Now, until now, we have been assuming that we, if we see the Esra, it's the wheat, grapes, and now we have all these mafarshim who think it is the fig tree. It's interesting that there is a final opinion in the Medrash. We saw this, I think, way back when, but it's worthy of repetition. A final opinion in the Medrash that says, perhaps we should pause for a moment. Amar Rav Shua ben Lakish or ben Levi, he says, Chas v'shalom. Who told you? Lo gila hakadosh baruch hu oso ilan l'adam. Hashem never revealed the name of the tree. V'lo asad l'gloso. And Hashem will never tell. This is a secret that will never be solved. Why? Re'e machziv. The pasuk tells us about a woman who is involved in bestiality with an animal. It's a horrific act of immorality. And what does the Torah say? That not only is the perpetrator, the man or the woman, killed, so is the animal. And you'll ask Akasha, right, which the Medrash itself asks, Behema machatas, what did the animal do wrong? Elder shalotehe behema veras b'shuk v'yomru zuhia behema shniskal plonio yada. What's going to happen? This man or woman is going to be stoned. They're killed. It's a capital crime. And then this animal is walking around. So in a month, in a year, you know, you can only imagine the high school kids, you know, on the day off, they're going to go, let's go see, you know, Miriam's ox. Why you call it Miriam's ox? Oh, didn't you hear that story a few years ago? This woman named Miriam, right? Or this is Mendel's ox. Right, it would be horrifically prost. It would be terrible. It would be, and more importantly, it would be humiliating to the person. Right, exactly. So therefore, says the Medrash, that's why the Torah killed the animal. That's the Torah's opinion. Therefore, we kill the animal, so it should be a constant humiliation to the person. It's one thing they did bad, they get killed, that's enough humiliation. Not forever and ever. But im al kavod toldosav chos hamakom. And if Hashem is so worried about our own embarrassment or humiliation, therefore he, and again, which toldo of Hashem, which person? Not Moshe Feinstein. Right? Not just, the biggest tzaddikus. Even a type of man or woman who did bestiality. Right? The lowest of the low, the most immoral type of behavior we can't even imagine. Thankfully. So, ugh. And about such a human being, Hashem is so worried about their kavod. Again, but catch the continuation of the Medrash. Al kvodo, al achas kama v'kama. Not on the tree, not on his own covet. What point is the Medrash? Just tease it out. It does the Medrash, as it so often does. It makes the point without saying it explicitly. What's the Medrash saying here? That's incredible. So powerful to consider.
People see that the fig tree, if it really was a fig tree.
Whatever, you're right.
You're right. They'll say, hey, that's the thing that people tripped up God with, or whatever.
In other words, just point out the last point. In other words, to put it this way, as much as we've been focusing on the great calamity to humankind that the Eitz Hadas and this Avera was, says the Medrash, there was something else that happened also. This was humiliating for Hashem. This brought great shame to Hashem, what we try to call it, in shorthand, Achil Hashem. An ultimate Achil Hashem. Here was Hashem creates a world, he has all these plans. He can't even get out of the first day. Here Hashem creates he can make them any way he wants. They're handmade by God, perfect human beings. And he gives them not a million mitzvahs, which you would think they should be capable of handling also, one mitzvah. And in less than one day, maybe even according to one opinion, 1 hour, they already trip up. I mean, you know, God, he can't do anything. You know, God can't get it. He needs a mulligan, he needs a do-over. Like, what kind of God is that? It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. It was shameful to Hashem that such a thing happened, right? It's a betrayal. It's a betrayal. We have this, again, Lahavdil, especially either if we're teachers, especially sometimes with our children, unfortunately. It's not just when they do something that's wrong that can be difficult, but very often it's a violation of trust. We betrayed them. They betrayed us, whatever the case may be. And that is incredibly painful. Adam and Chava betrayed Hashem. They betrayed his trust. And that was an incredible chil Hashem. And it humiliated Hashem, kavyachol. And again, the Medrash here is aware of how powerful a statement it's making, because it does what it does not so often do. How does it end? What's the last word of the Medrash? It's maha, which is a basic way of saying, wow. That's a wow. The Medrash, it doesn't just say, the period, the sentence ended before that, the word before that. But the Medrash ends with a, this is incredible. Wow. You just got something really special. Hashem. So again, what that fourth opinion says, we don't know if it's a fig, we don't know if it's an ester, we don't know if it's a wheat, and that's the point. We're not going to know. Don't think that you're going to be so clever as to say, well, they used a fig tree to cover themselves. Oh, must be Hashem was cutesy-putesy telling us what tree Eitz HaDaas was. Chas v'shalom, Hashem would never tell us, because it's so painful and so humiliating. Just to point out, so I can give out my my props in a moment, if you take a look at the Ibn Ezra, points out that he thinks that, on the contrary, there's a proof against the notion that the Eitz HaDaas was the Teina. Against all of these opinions, says the Ibn Ezra, Pashtan par excellence, they're all missing the point. After all, says the Ibn Ezra, third to last source, Ilu Haya Kain, if it's really true that the Eitz HaDaas was a fig tree, Haya Kosov Omer, Yisperu Alei, Eitz HaDaas. Why is it, by the fact that we've been talking about one tree calling it Eitz HaDaas, and then the Torah says, and they use fig leaves, says the Ibn Ezra, you know, you're looking at it and saying day, but I'm telling you, it's night out. He's looking at the exact same evidence, as we do, the exact same psukim as the other Mefarshim, and he says, on the contrary, the very fact that it mentions this, it wouldn't have had to mention it if this is what they were talking about. The very fact that it was mentioning it is a way of showing that that must have been talking about something else. I want to just point out to you that if you take a look at the Medrash in Rashi, Rashi specifically, as they would say in Yiddish, bavorns this. Rashi specifically gives an explanation which clearly, I don't know that, you know, is meant to, so to speak, defend this chazal and these opinions from the criticism of the Ibn Ezra. If you take a look at the next Rashi, two Rashis later, Alei Te'ina, the third Rashi on the Pasuk, what did Rashi say? Again, he's of this opinion, there was a fig leaf, whom ate achlimimeno, this is the tree that they ate from, a davar shaskalkabo, and itkinu, right, we saw that from the Medrash, that they're fixing themselves with the same tree that they messed up with, the other trees didn't want to have anything to do with them. Now we're up to the point that's relevant for us. Bottom line, even according to this opinion, the Torah didn't come out and say that the Eitz HaDaas was a fig tree. It hinted at it. Just say what you want, say what you mean and mean what you say. Why didn't the Torah come out and say it? It says Rashi, for a good reason. Hashem was worried not only about his own kavod, which was the other medrash, says Rashi here from the medrash, Hashem was worried about the kavod, the sensitivity of the tree. Why? Because shelo yachlimu v'yomer, he didn't want that everyone else should be humiliating this tree and say, quote, zeu shelako omayad, everyone will walk by, you know, if this is what we're worried about with the animal and the woman, so for every history we're going to say, look, no, it's so difficult, I have such a terrible life on the fig tree. It's all the fig tree's fault. Right, the rest of human history, the fig tree has to go through, or the estrog or whatever. So true, says Rashi, it was a fig tree. And I, it's a little bit like this, that the Torah didn't come out and say it and hinted at it. Says Rashi, yes, because Hashem is not just worried about his own kavod. Hashem is more importantly worried about the kavod of his creations, not just his people, but even history. So here you see the back and forth, the arguments, both in terms of pshat, and even in terms of philosophical implications that people have over whether this pasuk could be used to indicate whether the tree, the Eitz HaDaas itself, is a fig tree. This last comment of Rashi was from Medrash Tanchuma, and if you take a look at the source, I gave you the actual Medrash Tanchuma. Last source on the sheet. So this is just interesting. This comes from, there's other sources that talk about this as well, but the Ibn Ezra says the Yisperu, right? They sowed. What did they sow with? They had leaves. Maybe they wanted to, like, hold, you know, again, sometimes it's like the classical cartoon, you know, someone, you know, walks in on you and you're not dressed, so, you know, you're holding something in front of you, like, embarrassed. Okay, so maybe they could hold the fig leaves in front of them, but what did they have to sew? Mr. Kim was not coming there, you know. Who was the tailor? Who was doing it for them? You know, corner of Clarkson, Reisterstown? Okay. Okay. So says the Ibn Ezra, Hamavakshim, Machat, Mahavilam, the cynics who will say, and us, you know, and a needle, who gave it to them? Where'd they get it from? Says Ibn Ezra, they're silly. Kib eitz dak, yasu tzarcham. You can take a very thin branch, and it can serve the purpose as a needle. So I want to end with a story and pictures to show you. We were in Eretz Yisrael for the Shul mission a few months ago. Seems like it was just yesterday. One of the things we did was there is a nature slash nature preserve, which is also such as a nature preserve, it's also like, if you will, the halachic or Tanakhi version of like a colonial Williamsburg. It basically is this huge park which gathers together not only all of the plants and flowers from the time of Tanakh or Chazal, but they also have not necessarily active reenactments, but they have models of all sorts of incredible things, not just for flower and plant life, from the time of Chazal. So for example, their most famous thing is that all of the weird sukkahs that are mentioned in Masechta Sukkah, some really weird ones that are kosher, some really weird ones that are therefore not eligible for these sukkahs, they built them all. They have a sukkah there. I have a picture of me under it, four stories high. That's too high. There's a sukkah that's the minimum shear which you have to bend in to get in. That's just kosher. They have a sukkah there. They have all sorts of a sukkah made out of dalaninim. They have that. All sorts of incredible things. They also have a whole part of the park called the Shivas Haminim section. So one of the first things we saw with the Shivas Haminim when we saw fig trees. And this woman who was taking us around, our tour guide, started talking about our pasuk. And the medrash that really the Eitz Hadas was this, and how did they sew it? So sure enough, she asks the volunteers, we break off some of the leaves. Usually when you're one of these places, you can't touch anything. So here they said, no, everyone break off some fig leaves, and we had the branches. And she showed us, if you know how to do it, she used, again, not as a needle with thread in it. No thread. But she used those as kind of the needle. You could have two of those big, you know, leaves, and you put it, you know, you like that, and it held them together. So she wanted a volunteer. We had a group of almost 30 people, men, women, some children. She wanted a volunteer who wants to be the model. She'll show you how can you make a loincloth. How can you cover yourself as Adam and Chava did? So who do you think raised their hand? Nobody. So who had to raise their hand? The rabbis. I'll pass you around. You can see pictures. There's four of them. I'll give two to the women at first. And to the metaphors, you will see me wearing this. This is held together by little branches. Exactly what the Eben Ezra says. These are held together. There was no other attachment. I was there. I saw it. She made it with these little branches. Exactly what the Eben Ezra says. You can make a needle out of a little branch if you know what you're doing.
Use it like a pin.
Yes, exactly. Okay? Okay? Anyone who tries to sneak one of those pictures out of this room is not welcome back.
The other view. Right?